Members, we have three bills before us today, and we do not yet have a quorum, so we can't take any formal or official action right now, but we can hear testimony. So I'd like us to start with our own committee member, Representative Johnson, who's been patient. And Representative Johnson, we won't formally move your bill because we can't, but why don't you tell us about House File 2018. Oh, no.
That's right.
2018. Right.
Good afternoon. I do have one technical amendment for this bill. It was brought to my attention by the Secretary of State's office that if this is normally enacted on August 1st, like most bills, it would be in the middle of the election cycle and it could affect the elections. So the amendment is makes it that it does not go into effect until, I believe, it's January 1st of 2015. I'd like to move that amendment.
Oh, and this is the A1 amendment?
The A1 amendment.
Okay. Well, we can't formally act on the amendment until we have a quorum, but you've just described the A1 amendment, and once we have a quorum, I'm sure that won't be a problem.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Well, members, this bill came to my, brought to my attention last year, where a person can live outside of a district or even the state and filed for and forced primary elections for non-state level offices, such as the county commissioners, city councils, school boards, and township officials. These people who can file for an office and never set foot in the state of Minnesota, the district, and force those primaries, costing the taxpayers of those areas money to run the primary elections. By the state constitution, we cannot stop them from getting on the general ballot. The state constitution says it has a residency requirement of just 30 days before the general election. But we, in Minnesota, we have two ways to get on the general election ballot. One is by filing and paying the filing fee, and the other is by petition, where you go around, have your feet on the ground in the district, going door to door, collecting the signatures to have your name put on the ballot. What this bill does is put some of the residency restrictions on the filing fee, requiring them to live in the district or in the state of Minnesota for 1 year and live in the district 30 days, either 6 months before the filing fee or 30 days before the filing, or six months before the general election, or 30 days before the filing, start of the filing period, whichever is earlier. And if you do not qualify for that, then you just have to get the signatures and file the petition, and so you actually have feet on the ground in the district. I personally believe that if you're going to represent a district, such as a county, or a county commissioner, a city council, a school board, or even a township official, you should have lived there so you know what's going on in that community. The way the current law is right now, somebody from San Francisco can jump on an airplane, land at MSP, jump on the light rail, come to St. Paul, file for the mayor of the city of St. Paul, get back on that train, get on his airport, go back home, does not have to even set foot in Minnesota until 30 days before the general election, should he happen to get through a primary election. I feel that is wrong. If you're going to represent an area, you should spend time learning the district, learning what the community needs. The reason I bring this forward is this actually happened in a county in my district. There's a gentleman, we believe he lives in Wisconsin. Last cycle, he forced a primary in the commissioner's race. 2 years before that, he did the same thing. So it's the last two times in the last 4 years he's forced a primary in Chisago County. And that person doesn't even live in Chisago County. He has land there, but he just does not plan to move there unless he gets through the primary election. I spent many hours trying to figure out how to go around the Constitution. The filing fee has been held up by the Supreme Court as being allowable for elections getting on the ballot. but it does go through a primary. If a person doesn't live in that area and wants to run, I feel he should be going door to door getting the signatures, and that's what this bill forces them to do. And with that, I'm up for any questions.
Before we go to questions, it sounds like there are a number of other testifiers here, so maybe we should go to them first. Mr. Berenson?
There's Daniel Hoffman from the city of Rush City in one of the districts, and also Bo Berenson from the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Whichever one of you wants to go first. We do now have a quorum, so thank you, Representative Winkler. So Representative Johnson moves that House File 2018 be re-referred to the General Register. And, you know, why don't we adopt the A1 Amendment, too? The A1 Amendment, members, just changes the date. This was something agreed to by the Secretary of State's office. So all in favor of the A1 Amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The A1 Amendment is adopted. To the testifiers, whomever wishes to go first, just identify yourself.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Bo Berenson, representing the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all 87 counties in the state. I want to offer my thanks to Representative Johnson for bringing this bill forward. This was an issue that was brought to our association by the county commissioner that was mentioned earlier in testimony, who was challenged by an outstate resident who, under current law, could force a primary election without any obligation to move to Minnesota, much less the actual district he was vying to represent. Unfortunately, the commissioner who brought this issue forward was unable to make the hearing today, but I am joined by Daniel Hoffman, who is very familiar with the situation and can share more details of what occurred. I do want to say that AMC's official policy position on this matter is that a candidate for county office should be required to live in the district they are trying to represent for at least 30 days before the primary election date. Obviously, this bill goes slightly further from that, but it certainly meets the spirit of AMC's position. And in order to force a primary against an elected official, there should be some guarantee that you'll live in the state or the district when the primary occurs. With that, I'm happy to take questions, or I'll turn it over to Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Berenson. Mr. Hoffman, please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Chairman Simon. My name is Daniel Hoffman. I'm happily retired in Rush City in northern Chisago County. In the 2012 election that's been referenced here, myself and many others were surprised weren't surprised at first when the incumbent commissioner in the 5th Commissioner District filed for re-election. A resident of the district also filed to run for that same office. But before filings closed, a third person who lived in Wisconsin and had rented a small engine repair shop in Wyoming, Minnesota, still outside the district, filed for that same office. As time wore on, it appeared that the sole purpose, well, there were twofold. One was to force a primary in the belief, misguided belief, that with two challengers, there's a chance, that the incumbent would come in third, and that would suit his purposes. Secondly, more importantly, I think, is it opened the door for this candidate to disseminate mailings. He never came to the district. He did a lot of mailings, and quite frankly, they were vulgar, they were obscene. I had one person tell me he would no longer let his grandkids pick up the mail out of the mailbox on the street. He said they were so offensive. He put off-color jokes in it as part of his campaign literature. It was pretty disgusting. Some of us believe in that district that one of the reasons he felt confident or facilitated in doing, you know, perpetrating this behavior was because he didn't have to worry about being confronted at the grocery store or having to defend himself at the local gas station. He was never even close to the northern part of the county. I guess when I went to high school a long time ago, government class, I was with a representative of democracy. We were taught that, you know, a person, you know, people in a given geographical area pick somebody and they vote for them and send them off to government. And in this case, we were surprised. Many people in the 5th district were very surprised that you didn't actually have to live in the district until before the general election, which allowed you to run from really anywhere in the primary. And so certainly I thank Representative Johnson for bringing this forward. I think it's fairly critical. I just would like to think that, I certainly don't want to get into the Constitution, but I would like to think that if you're going to run for office somewhere, you should live there. Thank you very much. Appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Any questions from members or comments? I actually have one for Mr. Burnson. Has AMC satisfied itself that this is okay constitutionally?
To be quite honest, I think I'm no constitutional expert, but I think the way that the bill was drafted to get to that idea that you still can be on the ballot if you're able to get a petition signed. I'm not a lawyer, so I'd hesitate to give you a legal opinion on that, but it certainly seems to be an elegant way to attack the problem we've identified with the requirements of the Constitution.
I know that Mr. Gehring and House Research have looked into this as well. I just wanted to get a different perspective on that dimension of this. Members, are there any other comments or questions or concerns? Anyone else in the audience who seeks to be heard on this bill? Okay. Well, if there's no one, which doesn't appear to be anyone, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2018 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor? Aye. 2018 aye. As amended, pardon me, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson. We're waiting for Representative Hansen, and members, the reason we're not proceeding then with the third bill, House File 1961 by Representative Halverson, is that Representative Dowd made a specific request that we hold off until he's here. He has some comments, or at least wants to be part of the debate here, and so out of respect for him, I think we'll go with the standard order, even though Representative Hansen's in the Tax Committee, and he's been summoned already. He should be here any second, so just, yeah, why don't we approve the minutes of February. Okay, we're looking for him. Representative Lane, would you like to move approval of the minutes of February 25th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move those minutes.
Okay, Representative Lane moves adoption, or approval, rather, of the minutes of February 25th. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. We'll wait just for a second for Representative Hansen. Thanks for your patience, members. Normally, we'd go to the third bill, but out of respect for Representative Dowd, we want to wait until he's here. Here's Representative Hansen. While Representative Hansen is making his way down to the testifier's table, I will move that House File 1408 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. That's the motion. Welcome, Representative Hansen. Your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. And I don't know how familiar committee members are with soil and water election district law, but I want to kind of reference beyond the bill to a piece in your packet. It's a long legal sheet that has some numbers on it. And I think the key thing to look at is that soil and water districts in general are soil and water district supervisors are elected on a countywide basis. But in order to run for that office, you need to run from a nomination district. So the nomination district that you represent is not based on population. It is based on lines drawing, dividing up that county. About 10, maybe 12, 14 years ago, the Soil and Water Districts came to the legislature and provided for a change in law where Soil and Water Districts, on a voluntary basis, could go to keep the county-wide election or move to election by county commissioner district, which would be based on a one-person, one-vote election. Only one of the 91 soil and water districts has done that. That was Washington County, and you may remember last year there was a bill following up with a technical correction on Washington County's election by district. At-large districts were common in our country for a variety of elections before the Civil Rights era, because you would have folks running from an area, a regional area, on a countywide basis. What House File 1408 does is it seeks to change that in the metropolitan area, where the county district, where the counties are so large that you may have hundreds of thousands of people voting in these races, and there is a disparity between the nomination districts that they would represent. Before I was elected to the Minnesota legislature, I served two terms as a Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor. I ran from nomination district, Soil and Water Nomination District 1. And if you look, and I'd ask you to look on the legal sheet of paper down in the lower left-hand corner, the population for Soil and Water Conservation District, Nomination District 1, is 210,000 people. So my vote on that Soil and Water Board running countywide was equal to a supervisor elected from a nomination district where there were 3,640 people. Now that's the largest population difference I think you'll find. I did not put the in this sheet from House Research, did not ask for Washington County to be included in it, because Washington County is already elected by county commissioner districts for a one person, one vote. And I did not ask for Hennepin County, because last year we also provided for Hennepin County commissioners, the Hennepin County Board, to determine whether they should take over the Hennepin Conservation District. Mr. Chair and members, there is an effective date that we need to put in the bill as an author's amendment, guidance that I received from the Secretary of State's office. If someone could move the A1 amendment to get the bill into the shape that I'd like, like it to be in.
Representative Hansen, I'll move adoption of the A1 amendment. And this is, members, just like we had with the last bill, Representative Johnson's bill, this would just put the effective date out to January 1st, 2015. Any member comments or questions on the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the motion to adopt the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Gehring, if there are other particular questions on some of these issues in districts, you can look at the population, the total number of voting, and the votes cast, and you'll see some significant disparity between districts. In the Soil and Water Conservation District world, I think you'll hear testimony later on that some people are not going to like this change. I understand that change is hard. The Soil and Water Conservation District State Association has tried to get tried to have the districts determine whether they should do this voluntarily each year. We've had, I believe, at least five or six cycles that we've gone through, and again, only Washington County has voted to change itself. What's the outcome here? The outcome is you have some races where there's no opposition because the nomination district is pretty small, and you have some places where there's huge competition without a primary, and then you have folks being elected with a relatively small percentage of the vote. I think there's the concern why nationally we got rid of at-large elections at a local level was because of concerns about disparities and who gets elected. And when you look at who does get elected, there's not a great deal of diversity in background or makeup of the persons who are being elected when you look statewide or in the metro area. So if we want our elected officials to look like Minnesota, I think going to a one-person, one-vote thing particularly in the metro area, is an important step. I realize there would be a greater opposition to this if it was statewide, and that's why I'm not asking for that this time. So I'd be open to any questions.
Representative Hanson, I have a question. Do you know, has the current scheme, as you described it and as you've laid it out here, do you know if it's ever been subject to a legal challenge?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to my knowledge, it hasn't, and I think just my... This is usually pretty low on the interest level for... I think you'll see the drop-offs between... You can see the drop-offs of it in terms of some of the other election races and then when it comes to this race. But to answer your question, no, I'm not aware of any legal challenge.
Representative Hanson, I think we have one testifier for sure who signed up to testify. Is Ms. Vanney here? Great. Welcome to the committee. Just identify yourself, if you would, for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Sheila Vanney. I'm the Assistant Director with the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. And the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts does support the current SWCD statutory language providing for the local SWCD board's discretion in how they are elected. As Representative Hanson mentioned, each election cycle, our organization, jointly with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, does provide guidance to the soil and water conservation districts across the state to remind them to review the current process by which they are elected. Historically, when you look at SWCD elections and the election countywide but distributed geographically across the county, they are at a crossroads or an intersection of representing the soil and water conservation resources, the land and water resources throughout the county, in addition to representing the voice of the people in addressing those resources. So there's been interest in maintaining geographically across a county, just spreading out the representatives on that soil and water board to make sure that each voice on an SWCD board has this roughly the same geographic landmass area. And as we look forward to this legislation, we would oppose the change to make it mandatory. And if there are changes sought out of concern for multiple individuals running for a particular SWCD position, we would prefer to see us go the route of instituting primary elections where there are more than two candidates seeking an individual position on the SWCD board.
Any member questions for Ms. Vanney? I have one, and I know you don't speak for every county and every unit here, but you know, Representative Hanson, no doubt because of his own experience, points to a pretty stark example here. I don't know if you have the handout in front of you, but you know, he points to a variance in size of these districts all the way from 210,000, just within the same county, to 3,640. I don't know, I'm not sure, and I'm not asking you, I guess I sort of am asking you to answer for Dakota County, but just momentarily, I'm trying to get around how they would get past the one person, one vote principle here. I mean, it seems like quite an imbalance here. What do you think, what's the best response?
Well, I am not a constitutional expert either, but if you look at it from the perspective of every voter in that county has a say in every position on that SWCD board. So, I mean, in that respect, all votes are equal, and that's, I guess, without getting into legal... delving into a legal analysis of it, that's my short answer.
That's interesting. I've never heard of any other voting arrangement where people vote for candidates that ultimately won't technically represent them. So if I have it correct, and I'm just trying to get my mind around this, so in Dakota County, for example, everyone votes for the soil and water folks for all five of these districts, even though they're only by definition represented in one. That's interesting. I mean, imagine if we did that here, where everyone got to vote on all legislators, even though they're only represented by one House member and one Senate member. I mean, it just seems to us, you can imagine from our vantage point, a little odd.
And I do understand that, Mr. Chair and members, and I don't want to take a lot more of your time, but the one concern we have is, for example, if in the case of Dakota, if the majority of the board members were in the northern tier of the county, because that's where the majority of the population is, that's not necessarily where the majority of the water quality issues are. And if there's only one individual that represents the rest of the county, he has a lot to stay abreast of in terms of what's going on in the landscape and what needs to be done to tackle those water quality and soil erosion issues. So, we do recognize urban water quality issues are a priority, but skewing the priorities in that far in the other direction, I think we have concerns.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Hansen,
if I could just respond. So on a five-member board, it takes three votes to pass something. So if you take a look at Dakota County and you look at the, if you take a three-vote majority, it may not even add up to one of the other two votes in terms of who's voted there. So the opposite of what Ms. Vianney said can also apply, because how you spend the public money is the result of a majority vote of the people elected on that large basis.
And so, Representative Hansen, what you're saying is, to use your depiction here on the bottom left of first page of your handout, if you had the commissioners from districts 3, 4, and 5 comprising the majority, if you add up those populations, they wouldn't even come close to reaching the size of Commissioner District 2. Is that your basic point?
That's my point.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the question I have is, I'd like to take your point, get your point of view on the fact of fair representation on this. If basically what I'm seeing, looking at these numbers, especially in Dakota County, District 1 could actually, they have the vote and they have the population to totally control the entire county. And I'm just wondering if you think that is fair.
Who is the question to, Representative Johnson? Ms. Vanney?
Yeah.
Certainly the question of fairness and equity come into play when we're combining where's the money coming from and where is the representation and the voice for where that money is coming from, combined with where should it be directed to. SWCDs receive part of their funding through the local property tax levy through appropriations from their county. They also receive federal grant dollars and a good portion of state allocations and competitive grants. So their funding mix is somewhat split if you look at that in terms of a given property tax, a property owner or citizen in a given area of the county, and how much of a voice they have on the SWCD board. Again, I guess I would go back to, not all of the water quality priorities are going to be where the population is centered. And we get into this debate or discussion when we're sitting in the Committee on Environment and Natural Resource in Ag Finance and trying to appropriate the constitutionally dedicated clean water funds, for example, because most of the tax revenue comes from the metro area. Should most of the funds be devoted back to that part of the state, or do we look at the state as a whole and see where are the water quality concerns and priorities and try to make sure that they're being targeted where they're needed the most? I guess I don't have a I don't have a straightforward answer on that.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, thanks for bringing this forward for discussion here today. We appreciate that. And I know that we spoke a little bit about this yesterday. Was it Tuesday? I don't even know what day it is today. We spoke about it earlier this week. My question is, are you open to changing that shall to a may on 1.9 and allowing maybe those counties in the 7 metro area to have the ability to move to this if they desire? Or do you think it's important in your mind that we must make these 7 county metro areas force them to pass the resolution to move into this?
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, May is the status quo and has been for, and I, staff could correct me, but I think it's at least 10 years, maybe 12 years. Mm-hmm. So for 12 years, the districts have had the opportunity to choose. One has. I'm going to be really blunt here and just say I don't think they're going to change. I just don't think they're going to change without us changing. They're not going to make the status quo. They're the product of the status quo, and the status quo will not change without us changing. And I think, why do we want to change it? I think we look at the disparity in voting here. This is money that, Ms. Vianney's right, there's money that comes from the property tax level into the county. The county provides money for the districts, but also we provide money for the districts. We provide money through general services dollars, general tax dollars, but also legacy dollars. So I think there is a role for us here. I just think when you look at these metro counties, there is such a huge difference in terms of the voting that if we stop 100 people on the street and just ask them about this, well, maybe 25 would say, what's a soil and water district? But there, I mean, there's, and just on that point, you know, I've been out of it now for almost 10 years. Every election, I still get questions about who's running for soil and water district, and I get them from each of these counties, from people living in each of the counties, because I've been a soil and water supervisor. People call me or email me and say, who's running? And after 10 years, I'm not keeping track of it anymore. You know, people have kind of cycled through, but and that's a piece of this. At huge elections, when you're running countywide, and I'll take the big three of Dakota, Ramsey, and Hennepin. If the major papers, if any other media do not cover the election, then you have folks walking into that ballot booth and seeing two or three names countywide for the first time. And that's why you have the drop-off on the vote. That's why you have certain names may get elected with familiarity and name recognition that doesn't have anything to do with that particular candidate, because people are not able to get information about the candidacies at those very large levels. I don't think there's ever been a soil and water debate on Almanac. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So by electing by district, and I think this is what Washington County has shown, the world didn't end in terms of soil and water elections. They've been able to do it, and you have a smaller group of people who learn about the candidacy.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, you have just raised an interesting civics lesson in my mind on this. This is sort of U.S. Congress representation by population or representation by state, and we've got one of each chamber on that. I guess I'd like to ask Mr. Gehring, why would these not be subject to the traditional rules of reapportionment that just about everything else needs to in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, so the districts that exist currently are technically considered nomination districts. So the districts are used to choose candidates who will run at large in the general election for the districts when they're voted on by the whole county. So current law doesn't require that nomination districts have substantially equal populations. If this bill were enacted, the new districts, essentially what would happen is that these districts would be required to go through a redistricting that would have population requirements. So if you're just using districts for purposes of nominating candidates, there isn't this constitutional one person, one vote requirement because you're not actually electing those candidates. But once you start electing candidates from districts and they specifically are elected to represent a specific district, then you do have the population standards that would apply.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very intrigued by the changes that Representative Hansen is putting forward. This might be a great un-idea for the legislature to look at. All of the arguments that I've heard about, well, dollars coming from an area of certain wetlands or certain water features and different things that we're trying to protect, that happens everywhere. And I would be willing to bet that you talk to the different people in Minneapolis, it's like, well, you know, we have the larger population of base of employment, or we have more transportation-related issues in this area. We have more of the tax base in this area. But everybody on the city council has an equal vote because it's a community. And I'm looking at these soil and water boards being inside the county, which is the overlying government or the umbrella government, not each one of the separate districts has its own domain or its own independent province. I'm just wondering if this resolves the problem for the state, or if it's a bigger global. Granted, it's not for the entire state. You're talking about some selected metropolitan counties on this, but I just ask: is the question more global for us in the state of Minnesota, or are these states, are these counties carved out with something that's a little different than I might see in Stearns or Benton County? Because no offense, Representative Hansen, to the testifier, but my people in my district say, are those the ones that are next to the judges on the ballot when we go through, which we all know about some people's predisposition to the judges on the ballots as well. So or maybe more commentary and philosophical thoughts than a solution or a question there.
Representative Hansen, any comment?
I personally think that if you did this analysis for the Stearns County districts, you're going to be seeing a similar issue in terms of the disparity in terms of population. But I think you'd also probably have a few more people in the room who would be upset by having the change. But it's, I think we have to have our elected officials be in a fair system so that the people of Minnesota get representation that is fair and similar to the population. And when you have a disparity like this when running for countywide, I haven't made a financial argument, but let's say there was somebody who had the resources to run countywide and did want to do television ads or whatever, and somebody who didn't have that financial capacity. Ponder that for a moment, because that running countywide in the metro area is going to be different than running countywide in Stearns County or running countywide in Houston County, because of the ability to reach those voters, particularly when the mass media does not cover the race in general. So, and to follow up on Mr. Gehring's comment about nomination, this is why the terminology is kind of odd. Nobody's nominating you when you run. You are, when I ran, and I think the fee is probably the same, I ran down to Hastings and I paid $20 and filed and self-nominated. And then I was on the ballot countywide. So there's no, I think often when we think of nominations, we think of endorsements or political party nominations. These are nonpartisan elections. So the nomination district is you going and putting yourself on the ballot. And currently, as Ms. Biani said, it's anybody who filed is going to be on that November ballot if they pay the fee.
Members, any other comments, questions, concerns? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'll renew the motion that House File 1408 be re-referred, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy. All in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. We're now on to the third and final bill, Representative Halverson. This House File 1961. And members, you'll notice that there's a delete everything amendment, the DE3 amendment, so I assume we'll just take that up. Representative Halverson moves that House File 1961 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. That's the motion. Representative Halverson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this time it would make sense to move the DE amendment and so that we can. So I will move the DE3 amendment.
Okay. And we'll just do this to get it in the shape that the author wishes, and then we'll debate the bill as if it's DE3. All in favor of adopting the DE3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We've adopted the DE3 amendment to the bill as amended by DE3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, I know you've all seen a version of this in the past. We had an informational hearing on this issue prior to the official start of session. And the DE3 amendment makes a few changes to what we previously discussed, but I think the spirit is the same. By way of review, Minnesota and many states have been reviewed in terms of their public official disclosure regulations. And Minnesota has, in national surveys, come up wanting. We rarely come up short on surveys for how to do things well in this country, and Minnesota kind of is in the middle of the pack for its public disclosure integrity laws. That is not to say, and I will say this emphatically, that I think that our public officials are operating outside the bounds of integrity. I think that Minnesota has a high standard for integrity, and I think that, in general, elected officials and public officials act as such and meet those public expectations. However, it doesn't mean that we provide necessarily the transparency that the public expects. And so this particular bill is a move in that direction to provide additional transparency so that the integrity with which we operate is clear to the public. And so just briefly to points of the bill, Section 1 changes current law to require the Campaign Finance Board to audit our disclosures. We change it from a may, we change it from permissive to a must. Within the resources of the Campaign Finance Board, because it's within their available resources, having talked to the Campaign Finance Board, it sounds like they will be able to reasonably provide audits, and we would not be required to have a fiscal note on this bill. So just a technical point. On Section 2, disclosure of potential conflict of interest, as you all know, we recuse ourselves if there's any potential conflict of interest if we stand to gain financially from a vote that we would make on the floor. We're required to recuse ourselves. This would add our spouse's financial interest to that conflict of interest as well. And again, the recusal is not on any particular vote that we make that would impact any of our interests. The example I like to use is I have a kindergartner, and if we had voted to provide free all-day kindergarten, I pay out of pocket, but if we had provided free all-day kindergarten to everybody, would I have had to recuse myself? And the answer is no, because everybody with a kindergartner in Minnesota benefits equally. So that's the standard under which we operate, and that would continue. The financial disclosure forms that are filled out by public officials every year are also changed under this bill to add spouses. So we would also disclose spousal financial interests to our financial disclosure bills, including, and this is the biggest change, a listing of principal business activities under professional activity codes of the IRS. The IRS does designate particular industry codes that under their rules, and we adopt those as a way for the public to know which business interests an independent contractor, an independent operator might be working with and gaining income from
It does not go as far as to disclose individual clients. To me, that's an important distinction. There's a lot of push for folks to want to know who, if a private contractor, if an accountant, if whomever is working with a particular customer. I think it's behooves us to allow the client some privacy, regardless of who they're choosing to do business with. We know that our legislature is part-time, and people are engaged in other businesses to make a living. And so this is an effort to strike a balance between allowing the public a certain amount of transparency and making sure that we're operating with integrity, as well as keeping an appropriate ability for folks to earn a living and to make sure that we're getting good people running for office, so we're not making it too burdensome. And then finally, we allow our spouses are also included under that disclosure of business classification. So that's the bill as it stands today. I think I'd also like to say that we I think that this is really a joint effort. We really are working together to bring forward a bill that meets public expectations and also is something that respects the members of this body and other public officials. So happy to stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Comments? This does have, again, the motion is that this be referred to the Committee on Government Operations, so it does have another committee stop. So I would imagine we're not going to solve every issue here today to the extent that there are reservations or problems, but I think it sounds, Representative Halverson, I know you and others have done a lot of work on this, trying to get it to a point where we can truly get consensus. And it sounds like you're pretty close, probably not all the way there. I know there are members who still have some tweaks in mind and some changes, but it sounds like you're getting somewhat close. Mm-hmm. I think that Mr. Goldsmith wishes to be heard on this. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I'm here primarily in case there are some questions, but also to thank Representative Halverson for bringing this bill forward. You may recall that last year the board produced a very comprehensive public integrity bill, not with the expectation that it be advanced in its form that it was presented, but rather that it start to ask some questions about where the legislature wants to go with disclosure of conflict of interest. And so Representative Halverson's bill moves the state forward a couple of steps in that regard with respect to defining the scope of people who have to disclose their financial interests. I think more importantly even is the provision that finally, for the first time in our statute, reaches independent contractors and closely held corporations, two groups for which we never knew anything about relationships that might cause conflicts of interest. And it's a good compromise, as the chair has noted, because while we don't require those independent contractors or closely held corporations to disclose any client names, we now will require them to disclose categories in which they work, so that if a bill comes up that relates to one of those categories, members of the media, members of committees, or members of the bodies, and the public, in fact, can ask that official about those relationships to make a determination as to whether there's a conflict of interest. So the board does support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Any questions for Mr. Goldsmith? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldsmith, I'm just wondering a little bit the genesis of this bill, if the board was involved in the development of it or in the DE3 amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, the board was involved in the development of the DE3 amendment because we wanted to make sure that we had a bill that we would be able to administer that didn't leave a lot of things that were too vaguely defined for us to be able to determine what we were supposed to do. And so the bill was written by legislative staff and Representative Halverson, but with input from me.
Representative Halverson.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Representative Erdahl, After having numerous discussions and having heard this in committee once, we took a look at it with research staff, and as we were going through the drafting, with those big goals in mind that we had discussed broadly with folks on both sides of the aisle, and said these are the big goals. These are what we're trying to get to. How do we get there in a way that's, to Mr. Goldsmith's point, is something that we can administer as a state and that is reasonable to administer as a state? And so we really looked to the Campaign Finance Board as this bill was being drafted so that we knew that these IRS codes would work. It wasn't really clear. It was sort of started off as, this is just an idea. And does this work? And so we asked them to look into whether or not this works. There are so many codes that we actually did look at paring it down a bit because it could be unnecessarily burdensome for folks to dig too deeply through the IRS codes to find their codes, so we put it in state statute. So I hope that helps.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson or Mr. Goldsmith, the very first sentence in Subdivision 10, with limits of available resources, the board must make audits and investigations with respect to the requirements of this chapter. I'm curious as to what the qualifications are, I guess, of we say must make audits and investigations. How many is that? Who is that on? How are you triggered that you must make an audit? And to what level, to what scope? I understand we say within limits of available resources, but that doesn't really tell us much. Could you clarify what you're thinking, how this will play out in the real world, and how that would affect those that would be that would fall under this section?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sanders, that's a good question, and it gives me not only an opportunity, but I guess an obligation to make a slight correction to what Representative Halverson said. You pointed out that the language says must make audits with regard to this chapter, so this provision doesn't just apply to the section regarding economic interest disclosure. It applies to Chapter 10A. When the bill was heard in the informational hearing, I was sitting next to Board Member George Beck over on this side, and Mr. Beck leaned over and said, "What does this mean?" And I said, "It means that this elevates the need to do audits in our list of priorities, and that we have to give it some real consideration as we decide what we can do and what we can't do. We can't just put it all the way on the back burner so it never gets done." But I have to point out then that because this relates to audits in all of the provisions that we administer, which include, of course, campaign finance, it's a broad sweep. And we've always had the ability to do audits and never actually done them. We do investigations occasionally on our own. For me, what I think this means is that we will now be trying to allocate some resources to do audits, but I have told people, and I will tell you now, and if you don't like the idea, you can change the bill, but I don't think we would ever expect to do random audits. The resources simply aren't there to do that, and there wouldn't be much productivity in just picking out somebody's economic interest statement randomly to audit. I think from my perspective, from what I see in the board's offices, that there are more problems with the use of money raised for political purposes in the campaign finance program and how that money is used than there are in disclosure of economic interest. However, because this is an economic interest disclosure bill, we did put in, as you note at the very end, in Section 4, this section does apply just to 10A09, which is the economic interest disclosure, and we put in some provisions to protect the confidentiality of data that people might provide in an economic interest audit. And we thought that was important because to audit an economic interest statement, we have to somehow verify that what you put on the statement includes everything that should be on the statement. And the only way to do that would be to ask for things like brokerage account statements and so on, things that should not ever become public. And so that's the reason that protection of paragraph 9 is in there. So thank you.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Mr. Goldsmith. I do appreciate that explanation, but I still have I guess some questions as to if you're not going to make random audits, but you must make audits and investigations, which is at least plural, so you have to do at least two. You know, are you looking at doing two audits and investigations, 201 audits and investigations? And again, I know that we're saying within limits of available resources, but if we're not doing random, what is the trigger for the Campaign Finance Board under this entire chapter for them to know that they must and that they will take the action to actually audit and investigate someone that may fall under this?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, thank you. I think that your understanding that we would need to do some audits is probably a valid one, although I think I would differ on the conclusion that the bill actually requires any audits. Right now we have the resources to do that, so right now we would be able to at some time in the future, as we've faced in the past, times when we can't even keep enough staff to do the basic duties of getting reports in and taken care of, we might not. But right now we do have available resources. So the question is, how do we determine how much to allocate to that? And I think it's a balancing act, like with everything else the agency does. Can we do rulemaking? We need to do rulemaking. Now we need to do audits, and we have to balance the resources available. I have given this quite a bit of thought, and I have recognized over the years, and I've been executive director for more than 6 years now, I've developed a file of things that we'd like to look at. They happen to be all campaign finance reports, because that's the program that requires the most disclosure. And they are things that we see in reports that are different from what we would normally expect to see in a report. Certain numbers that are higher than would be normal for a committee of the type and size that we're looking at. Certain things that appear that they should be different numbers than the numbers that are shown, or that need more description than is given. And so we would establish criteria. I think I would have to go to the board at that point and say, here are the sort of criteria we have. If we do this type of criteria, we would have this many audits. If we do this, we would have this many. And I think the important part of an audit program is not the individual audit that gets done, but the fact that people will then realize that they're going to need to be more careful in how they report and how thoroughly they put information on the reports, because there is a chance that if they're not thorough, they will be audited. But your questions are good, and they're ones that we will have to struggle with over the next 6 or 8 months after this bill passes, if it passes.
Ms. Sanders.
Mr. Chair, then Mr. Goldsmith. So then, so what you would have to do is, would it be rules that would develop those criteria, or is it just, how do you develop that criteria? What's the official action of the Campaign Finance Board that develops that criteria, just so I understand?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, I don't think it would have to be rules, because the statutory authority to do audits is already there, although I don't think it would be a bad idea to have rules, although initially we don't have enough information on which we could base a rule. We have to look at the data that's before us and be able to analyze what sorts of things stand out. It's a question I'm not really able to answer at this particular point in time. I guess in a way it's one of those things where, to some extent, if a report deserves an audit, we sort of know it when we see it. There will be numbers that are often in all round numbers, even thousands, when that wouldn't normally be the case. Extraordinarily high expenditures in certain categories, or non-campaign disbursement categories, things like that. It'll be a discussion. The discussion on that approach will be in public session at the board meeting, as to developing the concept of audits and how we audit. Actual audits and the decision to audit any individual committee or person would be in an executive session, as already required by statute.
That's good.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things that I would either ask the author or Mr. Goldsmith. First of all, on page one of the DE amendment, We talked about the spousal financial interest. What happens if a spouse just flat out refuses to make that disclosure, and that is a separate person, separate set of finances, and how is a public official going to be penalized because a spouse refuses to make that disclosure?
Mr. Goldsmith, you care to field that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. I'll give a shot at it. It's a question that hasn't come up, obviously, and it's a good one because it's stopped us both cold here. The obligation to report is on the official, as you no doubt recognize, and so the question we don't have, I think, there is no obligation on the spouse to provide this data to us. We cannot go out and seek a court order compelling the spouse to provide the information, I don't think, as we could the official. I think it's ultimately, I don't have an answer at this point. The board would have to consider what it might do, and I think if an official simply can't do it, we might find the official in violation. I might add, with respect to that, that there would be some civil penalties for violation. Under current law, an official that actually fails to file a report other than a legislator is required to be suspended by the board, although it's unclear how that would happen. And in a technical bill that you'll hear hopefully later on this session, the board is seeking to have that provision removed. It's never been used, and we've actually never had an official that didn't file a report or resign voluntarily. But I can't answer your question as to what would happen. I can think about it and probably come up with an answer, but right now today I don't have an answer to that question.
I think Representative Halverson wanted to take a crack at that, and then Representative O'Driscoll will go back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one thing that I think is important to note is the spouses of elected officials go through a lot. It's you sign up for a big thing when you tell your spouse that you're supporting them in their run for office or run to serve their community. And so I don't take this lightly that we are adding spouses to disclosure. However, I do think it's important to note the scope of what we're talking about, that we're not talking about lengthy and intense disclosure, and it's probably not much more than the public would expect if we didn't disclose this. So if we were going to take a vote on something that our spouse's financial interests were going to be directly and uniquely and significantly impacted, I think that the public would expect us to not vote on that particular issue, whether or not it was disclosed on our disclosure forms. I think that if and it probably wouldn't, knowing that we're pretty close with our communities know a lot about us as representatives of our communities, and it probably wouldn't take a lot of digging from individual community members to say, hey, that something just doesn't smell right. This just makes it more clear to the public that we're going to be very open with us. And when you consider how many recusals there are per year from votes in the legislature, it doesn't come up, because it's got to be a pretty unique situation if it's going to affect you or your spouse significantly and uniquely financially. So that's would be my response to that. And
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Halverson's comment, two different things, I think. One is the obligation to recuse yourself because you do have the conflict of interest. The other is, to what Mr. Goldsmith, the question I proposed to him, a spouse flat-out refuses to make that disclosure, and there are some spouses that I know who say, leave me out of it, and really don't want to be involved in that, and we are now subjecting a elected official and or candidate to an obligation that they have no mechanism in which to enforce, but yet under Mr. Goldsmith's testimony today, they would be levying civil fines against an elected official for something they have absolutely no control over, except the statute says you got to dig and find what your spouse is up to. That can't be healthy for a marriage. Mr. Goldsmith?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the board carries out the statutes as given to them by the legislature. And I will say that when the board brought this
brought its major public integrity bill to the legislature last year. The board was split on both the issue of spousal and children's disclosure. The board didn't have a recommendation other than that the legislature take this issue up, because it is an issue that many states are dealing with. And so if the bill passes in its current form and we find that candidates are not disclosing spousal financial interests, I would presume that there will at least be some level of civil penalty lodged, probably not the whole amount. And I would expect that if that's really a problem, we will come back to you, the legislature, and tell you that it's a problem and ask you what your solution is for it.
Representative Driscoll.
I'll leave that topic, Mr. Chair. I think I've made my point on that. That's pretty problematic as it stands right now in the DE amendment. The other question that I have is, what happens if you have a situation where you have a spouse? Again, I'll leave it in that context since this is new provision that we're proposing for statute. Let's assume that a spouse has a classified position in a government agency such as the CIA and can't be disclosing certain pieces of information as a part of their official duty within the United States government or other kind of agency. And you may look at that and say, well, that's kind of funny, but if you go back not all that far in history, there have been issues where alleged outings of spouses and other kinds of things have happened which have compromised security for this country or alleged security for the country. And to think that we wouldn't have anyone potentially in those roles when, if I'm not mistaken, one was an ambassador with a spouse that was in this situation. There's a classic example.
I never anticipated a Valerie Plame question. That's what we have. Representative Goldsmith, or I'm sorry, Mr. Goldsmith, or
sure,
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the spouse would disclose only the name of the employer, which would be the U.S. government. And if that's specific enough to cause a problem, then the legislature should look at that. But I think in our experience that wouldn't be specific enough, at least in most cases that I'm aware of, to cause the problem. They don't have to disclose the branch or the work that they do or anything like that, just their employer in that situation.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I was going to just circle back again on the conflict of interest and the amount of digging and the standard that we are held to in terms of substantial and unique being financially advantaged in a substantial and unique way is the threshold and the standard, and I think it's a pretty high one. So I guess I would just leave it at that and make sure that we kind of keep the scope in mind of what we're talking about, that we're not suddenly talking about opening up all of our bank records or releasing our tax forms like we see some national officials do. So,
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, it helped to clarify where I was coming with on your comment and your subsequent comment, Representative Halverson. Anyone who knows of a conflict of interest in this position is required to disclose that. My hypothesis is, unless your spouse discloses to you as the elected official so you can disclose that information that we're proposing under the law, that individual would not even know whether they had a conflict of interest or not. And we're putting an elected official in a very tenuous situation the way that this language in this bill is written right now. And we can say, well, we'll come back and we'll ask the legislature to look at it. I'm raising this issue right now. Let's address and deal with the issue now so we don't have to put an elected official in an uncompromising position. Because the other thing that's happened in this is we've had some discussion about extending these from state officials to county officials in the past and to possible local officials. The next thing you know, we may be back here next session and or sometime in the future extending this to other groups of people where we've created a multitude of problems because of our expansion on that. I'm all for public disclosure on this, but I'm saying let's not intentionally put people in an uncompromising situation when we know right here today at our own admission and our own investigation that we've got some problems in that. Mr. Chair, if I might, with another question.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. On page 3, lines 3.1 through 3.5, and into the top of the next page, lines 4.1 through 4.2, the codes that we have here for independent contractors to disclose the nature of their business and activities, If I happen to be a venture capitalist, where would I fit in on that? I was looking at it, I was thinking 310 gambler might be, but I wasn't sure.
Mr. Goldsmith or Representative Halperson, I don't know who cares to take that.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I'll take that question. This, as Representative Halverson said, is an extraction of the list of professional activity and principal business codes from the IRS. It's not the complete list, and it was developed primarily by legislative staff. And we did add, just to cover situations like the question you raise, lines 4.1 and 4.2, which would allow the board to recognize additional codes that aren't covered here. And I think that your question would be one of the first ones that would come up in an advisory opinion is, where do I classify myself? And the board would need to recognize a new code. I think as the drafters of this document recognize that they would not be able to come up with every possible code, and I think you hit on one that we probably might have thought about, but we didn't.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
4.1 through 4.2. It says, other principal business or professional activity codes specified in board rules or advisory opinions. My question is, since it's not, if the code is not listed on the previous page, the some 30 codes that we see there, does the campaign finance board have the ability to create its own code? And if so, does the campaign finance board also have the ability to go back on the previous page, those 1 through 30 codes that we see, and further tier those down to collect information that might be in a situation in some communities or in some businesses in some marketplaces to inadvertently expose clients, which I know we're concerned about because of the fiduciary duties that some may owe others in contractual relationships?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the board would not have the ability to tier existing codes. If something is adequately covered in a code, that code could be used. The legislature specifies the level of detail that would be required. The board could create new codes where there isn't one that really is an appropriate fit, such as the example that you gave. And that language, by the way, let me back up one step. While these codes are derived from the IRS codes, these are not the IRS codes. They're codes numbered 1 through 30, 31, or really 1 through 30, which are the codes that will be the statutory codes. And so the board would be able to recognize new statutory codes. That language parallels exactly the statutory language regarding non-campaign disbursements, where there are 20-some non-campaign disbursements listed, and then one that says other non-campaign disbursements is recognized by the board in rules or advisory opinions.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just wanted to follow up on a different topic. And again, this is for clarification. Mr. Goldsmith testified earlier that closely held corporations and sole proprietorships are independent contractors. Two parts to this. Number one, what's the definition of closely held corporations for this subdivision? And number two, would that also include partnerships and any LLCs or LLPs as well?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, you can see on line 2.33, that it's an ownership interest in a company or in a business of 25% or more. So there's a threshold to what your ownership interest would be in a business. We do not extend disclosure to business partners in any way. And I will say there are some states that do so.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to express some concerns about the bill itself and some language in the bill. The first section, subdivision 10, I would agree with others that have testified that or other members that have asked questions about within the limits of available resources, the board must take audits and investigations. It seems to me that that's up to the opinion of the board to decide if they feel like they've got the right level of resources. So I'm not real comfortable with that language. I think the fatal flaw in this bill is 4.1 and 4.2. I know that the list of job classifications that start on 3.6 and continue down to the bottom of that page, that this list was kind of designed to be a little more general and a little less pointed, as was in the previous version of the bill. By design, I think, to make the bill more palatable to the legislature. And unfortunately, the line 4.1 and 4.2 that says, any other stuff that the board would like to add itself, we probably could delete all the rest of the bill and just give the board that line right there and just say, well, let the board do whatever they want to. I think if the first list wasn't palatable enough to get us through the legislature, this language is going to be the same fatal flaw to the bill. And I really appreciate the work that the board does. I think we've had a very good working relationship in my short time in the legislature here. But I think this is a little too broad, and I'm nervous in that the first answer from Mr. Goldsmith was that he suspects one of the first opinions that they'll have to issue, advisory opinions, is they'll get a request for, where do I fit in, and likely the board will be adding more classifications. And when I read some of the classifications, I get a little nervous about that too: political consulting, public or media relations, government relations, fundraising. There's some things here that, I don't know, political consulting, I don't know necessarily why that might be relevant to things we act on in the legislature, and I guess there's a decision, or not a decision, but somebody could have the opinion that applies to everything we do, that somehow, we could use a vote that we've taken here in the legislature or in committee, and because a spouse might be working in political activity, that vote could be used in a campaign, and all of a sudden every vote we've taken in the legislature is relevant to that. So I think there's just a lot of questions. I'm just expressing my opinion. I'm not comfortable with the language. So I don't have a specific question, but I don't have a lot of comfort for the language. I think this could use some more work.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, Representative Dowd raised questions about lines 4.1 and 4.2, as did Representative O'Driscoll. Could you just describe for us again what, in your opinion, that language authorizes the board to do?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler. It's not as broad as Representative Dowd is concerned about, because advisory opinions can't be generated by the board itself. An advisory opinion has to come in at the request of somebody who's regulated by the law and is asking for guidance on their own conduct. So it has to be somebody asking, essentially, can I report under this category, or can you give me a category to report under? So they'll come in one at a time. Advisory opinions are public, and they're discussed in public meetings. And if there's any input, that's considered by the board. The rulemaking process, as you know, is much more cumbersome. It has a lot of statutory requirements. If the rules are contested, there will be hearings, and they're always subject to review by the Office of Administrative Hearings. So rulemaking does not give the board carte blanche to add additional categories either.
Representative Whitley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I have a great deal of confidence in the measured response that your board would take to any of the advisory opinion requests or board rules to add to these lists. Frankly, I think this is a very, very, very modest bill, Representative Halverson, in its current form. Minnesota is really a very kind of abysmal state in terms of disclosure. And if you can't get a spouse to disclose or sign a statement about where she gets her income or where he gets his income, you might want to reconsider whether they actually support your campaign for public office. There is an obligation to the public if you want to seek that office. And the opportunities for mischief are just too many to say that that's an unreasonable burden to impose on a candidate or an elected official. And in fact, many states require much more than this. So I hate to say that I think you're all that all these concerns are unfounded, but I really think they are. In particular, Representative Dowd's comments about political consulting, media relations, and government relations, it is illegal, so far as I know, to pay a legislator to be a consultant in their own race. And I think there's been some suspicion about whether or not that's been happening. And certainly I think the public deserves to know whether their elected officials are primarily just serving in other campaign capacities or for their party and having their party pay them while they are serving in public office. And in fact, I believe there's been questions related to sitting members of the legislature about that. So I think that's exactly 27, 28, and 29 on page 3 are exactly the kind of things we need to know about. And Minnesota can do far more than it's currently doing and could go much farther than this. In fact, I think the idea of being sensitive about the names of clients is also a bit, except in very rare cases, you may have a case, and I know Representative Simon has raised this, where you may have a lawyer representing somebody who is perhaps going to be charged with a crime down the road. There may be narrow circumstances in which a lawyer should not reveal a client's name, but in general, the representation of a client is not a confidential matter, and it is not governed by rules prohibiting that confidence. And in fact, one of the things that you have to consider when you run for public office is the impact of that on your, in my case, legal profession, your legal work. And if one of the barriers to running is that you feel like you can't represent clients and run for public office, that's part of the sacrifice you make. I could put out a long list of them myself, and I'm sure all of us here could. So the public interest in knowledge of where money comes from, who's paying for what, I think is what's dramatically underrepresented in our current laws, a little bit underrepresented in this bill, and I think we have to at least take this step, and I don't think we need to delay it any further. Long speech, no question.
All right. Members, we're coming up on the end. We're basically at the end. If circumstances were different, this might call for laying the bill over. As you know, I mean, this is my 10th session. This is the only committee I've seen where we've laid a bill over sometimes two times to accommodate all concerns. I've never seen that done. So we have a tradition of that in this committee, but it is a short session. There were no amendments here today, which is fine because it's a short session, but we are going to take a vote on the bill, and I have confidence that in its next committee stop, particularly since I think Representative O'Driscoll, you serve on that committee, and so does Representative Sanders, so there's some substantial overlap here, and so does Representative Winkler. So I'm confident in the next committee some of these concerns can be more formally addressed by way of amendments. So with that, members, if there are no other comments, we'll take a vote on the bill. Representative Halverson renews her motion that House File 1961 be re-referred to the committee. House File 1961, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, thank you. The committee is adjourned.